Thank you. As I was driving up, or being driven up before, oh, well, maybe I'll get this mic into a better position. No problem. As I was coming up there before, I noticed the sign outside the shul, which described the, I guess, the title of the program or the purpose of the program, Renewing Our Spirit. And that made me very much aware of the fact that a day such as this presents every speaker with a double-edged sword. On the one hand, we are assembled here as scholars, hopefully as reflective folk, on the one hand. And on the other hand, one hopes that a day such as this also inspires and leads us to a renewal of the spirit, much as is advertised outside. Now, reflection and renewal are not always easy bedfellows. Very often, a heightened reflective sense actually cripples one in the area of hischadshus or hisodrus, and it's difficult to articulate a vision that incorporates both. I've spoken many times on the subject of Hasidus, occasionally on that of Kabbalah, and generally my goal has been hisodrus. It has been to inspire people to study, to action, to various life changes. But I felt that today I would try to incorporate a bit of reflection in the first part of my talk and move towards the area of Hesodorus only in the second, feeling that today's audience and the purpose of today's event is to both inspire our contemplative sense as well as our passionate sense. So first, to clarify our title. We're talking about whether Hasidus and or Kabbalah is relevant to the modern Jew. Now, the term modern Jew is a somewhat vague one, and I think that when we all read the advertisements for this lecture, perhaps conjured up various different images. So I jotted down a few definitions of what we mean when we say modern Jew. The simplest one would be a Jew who lives today, by which a definition every single Jew in the world then becomes a modern Jew. But I didn't really think that was what the titlers of the lecture had in mind. And I wrote down a few others. Modern Jew is a Jew who has an academic or a critical sense. That is, he subjects propositions to scrutiny, either scholarly or analytical scrutiny. A modern Jew could also be a Jew who is somewhat affected by modern values. And modern values, of course, are always evolving. And therefore, a modern Jew would be somebody who hears or feels or responds in a certain way, either logical or emotional, to the call of values that are contemporary. And finally, I thought the definition of a modern Jew might be a person who is in one way or another attached to modern culture, to the norms, to the interests, to the activities of the modern world. So as we explore our topic, I'm going to try to use all of these definitions in terms of the modern Jew and hope that we can see whether or not Hasidus and Kabbalah are relevant to any one of these four definitions. Now, in terms of defining Kabbalah, we're referring to a body of esoteric wisdom located primarily in two sources, in the Zohar literature, which includes Sefer HaZohar, Tikkuni Zohar, Zohar Chodesh, and secondarily in the writings of the Arizal and his Talmidim, Reb Chaim Vital, in Svarim such as the Eitz Chaim, the Pre-Eitz Chaim. Of course, there are other works of Kabbalah, Sefer Abahis, Sefer Yetzirah, Sefer Echalos, many, many other works of Kabbalah, and of course there are other schools of Kabbalah besides that of the Ari, prominent among them Moshe Kadavara, the Ramak. But essentially, the two focal points of the literature are the Zohar and the Kisvei Ho'ari. Now, this literature discusses many, many things. And some of it is basically the same as Midrashic literature, as Agados that we would find in Shas or in Medrash. But what distinguishes it, I think, is that it discusses that which is beyond reality as we see it. There is discussion of heavenly realms. There are discussions of the nature of the human soul. There are discussions of the essence of the divinity. So that it's a literature that deals with that which we do not see and deals with that which we do not see in great detail. So that is, I think, a working definition of Kabbalistic literature. I think it's important to note because there are those today who would approach this literature as separate and divorced from the ongoing tradition of Torah. And in fact, there are very popular schools of thought. One walks into any bookstore, one can find the writings of these people, that the Kabbalistic literature is part and parcel of the Torah tradition, and that antinomian tendencies that took place, whether in the person of the Shabbosai Tzvi movement or in other excesses in Jewish history, quickly were sort of shunted to the side, so that we have a movement that's operating within the framework of normative Torah belief and practice. Now, by Hasidus, or Hasidism, we refer to a three-pronged body of literature and knowledge, one that which deals with doctrine, Sifra Hasidus, the Torahs of Hasidus. There is a body of tales of Sipurim, of Rebbes and Tzaddikim, and then there is the cultural milieu in which actual Hasidim live. So these are the three areas that we will be discussing in terms of their relevancy to the modern Jew. Now, whether or not all this is important is a subject of great debate. There is a saying in the Sefer Degel Machne Ephraim for a Moshe Chaim Ephraim Sadlikov, the Degel, a grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, who comments on the Targum's translation of Ubnei Yisrael Yotzim Biyad Rama. The Targum translates Beresh Galei, which the Degel says is referring to Eresh is Reb Shimon Yochai, that the redemption of Klal Yisrael will only take place when the study of the esoteric literature has become popular. So Ubnei Yisrael Yotzim Beresh Galei, when this Reb Shimon Yochai is revealed to the people. And indeed, the Kamarna Rebbe of the mid-19th century, who was a great Kabbalist, and his voluminous writings are strewn with Kabbalistic references, the Kamarna was very much an advocate of Kabbalah as a study suited to yield redemption for the collectivity of the Jewish people. That is a pre-Messianic literature. And in fact, he's quoted as having said that when he would have his way, he would teach Zohar and Tikkunim to children of 5 and 6 in order to prepare them for the coming of Mashiach. Now, whether or not that was an exaggeration, certainly you get a sense of the importance that was attached to the study of Kabbalah in certain schools. And indeed, from the Arizal himself, there was a quote attributed to Reb Chaim Vital, that as the generations get lower and lower towards the end of days, the need for the study of Kabbalah will increase in order to offset the tumah or the yavida sadoros, the descent of generations, so all the more reason to study it today. So whether as a means to national redemption or as a means to personal salvation in the face of the end of days tribulations, there was a school of thought that felt that the study of Kabbalah was very, very important. And in fact, amongst certain Hasidic groups, certain, and I add certain, Kabbalah was in fact considered a proper subject for study. I mentioned the school of Kaman Azidachov before. Certainly the works of the Chabad Rebbes are essentially Kabbalistic works. The Radzina Rebbe, Rebbes of Radzin, are basically Kabbalistic works, and it varies. On the other hand, there was a pessimistic note sounded in Hasidic literature and in other literature towards the study of Kabbalah, which we're all familiar with. It is too much for the common man. One must first have one's stomach full of Shasim Poskim, not before 40 years old. We're all familiar with these quotes. And I just mentioned one from Rabbi Yosef Meir Machnifke, descended from the Chernobyl Rebbe's. The Machnifke said, Fleisch essen mit Kabbalah lernen geht nicht zusammen, which means meat eating and the study of Kabbalah does not go together, but which he meant that a person still sunk or attached to Gashmias in some way simply cannot study Kabbalah. It will lead that person astray. So there was this cynical note even within Hasidic literature. And again, especially amongst the Galtziana Rebbes, Tzans, Bells, and those schools, there was a sense that this is not for regular, ordinary folk. And there's a quote either from Tzans or from Bells, variously cited, that Hasidus today is simply Abaya Veruva in Tervistin Fayidin, which roughly translated would mean the study of Abaya and Rava, Talmudic study, and doing Chesed, doing kindness to other Jews, and the sense of pursuing the esoteric was actually frowned upon in those Hasidic circles. Now, there is also another discordant note sounded in relation to Kabbalah, and that brings us to one of the questions that I wish to pose in the more reflective part of our lecture. I once had a Rebbe in high school. A fine Talmud Chacham, very thoughtful man, who had reached the conclusion on the basis of his own both theological and historical speculation, reflection, that Kabbalistic literature was both historically untrue, that is, the claims that it made about itself historically were not true, A, and B, that it was teaching things that are theologically unsound, that the notion of sort of the different dividing the Godhead and things like this veered towards the heretical, it veered towards the denial of Yichud Hashem, and that the historical claims to authorship by Rav Shimon Bar Yochai and a secret transmission over a thousand-year period to early medieval Spain simply would not hold up to historical scrutiny. We'll discuss that soon. But this fellow was so adamant that that Kabbalah was close to being beyond the pale that he insisted that at his children's chasanas, that the Eidei Kiddushin at his children's weddings should be those who denied the authenticity of Kabbalah. And this created quite an amount of difficulty for him throughout the years, as you can imagine, and until finally he changed his demand. And he demanded merely that the Edim at these weddings should affirm the following statement. I believe whatever of Kabbalah is true to be true. So that that was at least a way out for him in which he could have Edim that he would be satisfied with. So again, there is this critical stance, even within Orthodoxy, which we'll speak about more. Now, in the Misnagdic tradition, of course, things varied. We're all, I think, aware of the fact that the Vilna Gaon and Reb Chaim Volozhiner put great emphasis in their own lives upon the study of Kabbalah. And, of course, the Nefesh HaChaim, Reb Chaim Volozhiner's major work, is full of references to Zohar and Tikkunim and so forth. And the Grah was obviously very much immersed in Chachmas HaKabbalah, in Sifrei Zohar, in the various Sifrei Zohar. On the other hand, the Misnagdish world generally reserved this study for an elite, a spiritual or a scholarly elite, although not calling into question its authenticity, at least not within the past 200 years or so. Now, As far as as far as Hasidus is concerned, there too we find rival claims. On the one hand, you find the letter attributed to the Baal Shem Tov, of which there are some different versions, but it is printed in the Sefer Ben Poris Yosef of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef Polnoya, the Baal Shem's, one of the Baal Shem's foremost Talmidim, in which the story is related. The Baal Shem himself relates a story that he ascended to the highest realms of heaven on Rosh Hashanah. His soul ascended, and there in the highest realms of heaven, he encountered the Mashiach, asked him, Emesai Ka'asimar, when will the Master come? And the Mashiach replied, L'kesh nefutza ma'nosecha chutza, when your doctrines will spread out as sort of wellsprings around the world, that's when Mashiach will come. And therefore, in Chabad, and in some other Hasidic schools of thought, the notion is that Hasidus, the study of Hasidus, is an important part of the Messianic process, much as we find similar claims made for the Kabbalah, that this is preparing us as individuals and as a collectivity for the ultimate coming of Mashiach. Now, I'd like to dwell for a moment, and switch back into the reflective academic mode, since I said that's one of the four definitions of the modern Jew that we had before, and accentuate the kasha of my high school Rebbe in relation to the Kabbalistic literature. The claim is that the Zohar and the Tikkunim and the Zohar Chadash were all written by Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, a Tana, and that they remained a text that the masses did not know about. They were transmitted amongst a spiritual esoteric elite and are first revealed in Spain in the 12th century. And there are claims that the Ramban sent this text secretly from Eretz Israel. There are other claims that it just appeared to Rav Moshe de Leon, who was the first revealer of it. There are those who believe it was transmitted, as I say, secretly throughout the generations. Now, again, to the detached scholarly reflective mind, this seems difficult. The notion that there should be no references to this text for 1,000+ years, it should be nowhere noted, gets the scholarly mind, it gets its critical juices flowing. And the critical juices are further amplified by the fact that there are some textual problems in terms of the Zohar. Just quickly mention a few of them. I'm sure some of us are aware of them. There is mention in the Zohar of Tanoim and Amoroim from different generations engaged in conversation and engaged in travels together with each other. There are mentions of cities of which we have no other historical source of their existence. Grammarians seem to feel that the Aramaic is not so ay-ay-ay in terms of Aramaic grammar. I'm not expert enough to decide that myself. And they therefore conclude that the text is what we would call today a forgery, and that it is not written by the author for whom it is claimed, and it was something that was put together throughout the generations. And this is pretty much where the scholarly universe stands today in terms of the Zohar. Now, that is quite a problem. Number one, because obviously later Kabbalistic literature, the Ari and the Ramak and other Mekubalim, are all based soundly upon the premise of the authenticity of the Zohar. So there are several ways out of that. Conceivably, one could say that the work is a true work falsely attributed to earlier authors. Well, that's a discomforting thought, that a saint privy to the deepest secrets of the Ribbono Shel Olam should use false authors. So that, I don't know if that's quite so comforting. And this is sort of where the scholarly community stands today. There is an attempt in scholarly literature to defend the authorship of the Zohar, and there is an attempt in Hasidic literature to answer some of the questions we raised before in terms of cities, in terms of persons from different generations. It is seen in Hasidic literature as further testimony to the otherworldly nature of the work, in that Tanoim and Amoroim were able to engage in conversations across hundreds of years and generations, again, further testimony to the divine source and the divine wonder of the work. But of course, to wrench, to tear the Zohar out of Jewish tradition in this fashion, not only undercuts the Ksavim of the Arizal and the Ramak and others, but again, to a large extent, Zohar and later Kabbalistic works have permeated Jewish tradition in Shulchan Aruch and in terms of Minhagim and Halachas and others. And of course, you have the greatest leaders of the past hundreds of years in the Jewish people, whether the Baal Shem Tov or the Vilna Gaon, the great Sephardic leaders, the Maharal of Prague, basically anywhere you want to go in terms of the various traditions of Klal Yisrael, with conceivably the exception of German Jewry, although there is some debate about the relationship of the Hirschian or the Neo-Orthodox towards Kabbalah. But with that exception, the traditional schools of Misnagdim, Hasidim, Svardim, all accept the authenticity of the Zohar, and therefore one must distance oneself to a certain degree from the main body of Klal Yisrael, and we'll have to discuss what that actually means as we go on. But I do note, in deference to the scholarly and reflective nature of our talk today, that this critique is a powerful, in fact, a powerful critique. Now, somebody lend me a watch. Is there a watch here that I can borrow? Perhaps just keep track of the time. Thank you very much. Okay, now let's talk about Hasidus and some of the problems which the scholarly type might have. Oh, I did want to mention one more problem as far as Kabbalah goes in terms of the modern Jew. And this relates to the subject that I discussed here the last time we had this sort of symposium in this shul, two, 3 years ago, Jews and non-Jews, and sort of the vision of the Torah and our contemporary acceptance of a universal humanism or universal morality. And that is simply the following, that however much we find many sources in our Masorah as troubling as far as the Jew-Gentile question and questions are concerned in terms of halacha, and basic hashkafa and halacha and agarata, this problem is accentuated far more in the Kabbalistic literature to a degree that, once again, if the basic halachas create a little garage in the kishkas, certainly the Sifrei Kabbalah on this subject are going to create a massive garage in the kishkas. So I just mentioned that as another part of the problem as far as Kabbalistic literature is concerned, in that the essential difference between Jew and Gentile is accentuated to an extraordinary, extraordinary degree. Now, turning to Hasidisha works, I will try to explain part of the problem that our reflective, critical academic might have as far as Hasidisha works are concerned. And here, I must backtrack for a second and explore an area which I think very often is left non-explored in almost all segments of Jewry, and really is at the core of our faith, of our repository of faith. And that is, once one steps beyond Tosha B'Ksav and into the rabbinic literature, there is a question always of to what degree this literature, and I don't mean the halachic literature, but the agadic literature, there is always a question of to what degree this literature is claiming to be true or claiming to say objectively true things, claiming to say objectively historical things, claiming to say philosophically binding, dogmatic things. And this is something that, although it might seem odd, we don't think about all that often. And let me try and bring the matter to some clarity. There is a huge midrashic literature which adds historical facts to the Chumash and Navi narrative. We are told Avram did thus and such, Moshe did this and such, and extensive factual additions to what takes place in Chumash. And much of our image of many of the figures in Chumash is shaped by this Haggadah tradition of who they were. Yaakov and Esav is a good example of that. And extraordinary number of historical facts. Now, are these to be regarded as historical facts? Are they to be regarded as metaphors? Are they to be regarded as entertainment tossed out to titillate Talmudic audiences in antiquity? And the question is not very often addressed seriously. Now, of course, if these are literal historical facts, the question is, of course, how can there be such a wide divergence of opinion? How can we have machlokas, extensive machlokas? Perhaps the tradition was lost. What is the source for these facts? Now, as much as this problem can confuse in the area of historical additions to the Chumash narrative, it can confuse far further when we are talking about the basics of faith and the details of heaven. For example, there much of what we assume to be the normative beliefs of Judaism and codified by the Rambam and others are based upon these kind of agadic discussions in Perek Chelek and other places, in which it would seem that one cannot know these things unless one is privy to some otherworldly source of information, or detailed descriptions of Gan Eden or Gehenim, detailed descriptions of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur in terms of what is taking place, discussions of forgiveness, discussions of death and punishment, discussions that seem to be revealing on the part of Chazal access to otherworldly sources of information. But if that is indeed the case, again, how are there machlokas? Are we talking about some kind of divine inspiration? What does the divine inspiration apply to? Are there different types of agadata? Many of us are quite prepared to say that the agadata can make mistakes when it comes to scientific facts. Why would God intervene for some agadata, not for other agadata? So I think this is a question, and the details of this question are often left unstated. We much rather enjoy a geshmaka, a Devar Torah. The Medrash here says this, the Medrash here says that. We can reconcile the two texts by saying this. Is that history? Is that reflection or juxtaposition and reconciliation of texts? Is that a means of deciphering what historically took place? Is it some sort of Torah game that, for what purpose? If one would say that these stories are to teach us moral truths, that will not get you very far, because many of them seem to be saying nothing in the way of moral truths, but just seem to be adding interesting, fascinating facts. So, again, this is an area that requires a lot of further discussion as to what is the source and to what degree are binding agadic statements about what we ought to believe, agadic statements about the cosmic nature of the universe, and then, of course, agadic statements about history and Chumash figures. And again, history and Chumash figures, you know, we're more at ease with, but when we push this over into the area of doctrine, and we push it over into the area of life and death and heaven and hell and Yom Kippur and so forth, Shavuos, again, is this all from some divine source, some miraculous divine intervention? Now, however difficult that question might be when it comes to the realm of Agadata, it is slammed in our face when it comes to the area of Kabbalah and Zohar and Tikkun and Zohar Chodesh and that whole literature. Because over there, it is 90% dealing with this sort of data. And when the Zohar tells us something about Sviros or about the four worlds, 10 Sviros, the nature of the malachim in each world. God is here, God is there, he went here, he went there, he ascended, he descended. This whole Kabbalistic literature, which is, as I said in the beginning of my talk, is always a peering behind the veil of reality as we see it. Well, then the question confronts us. Either this is somehow a divine revelation, or else it is fantasy. Now, moderns like very much to say it is neither. It is a symbolic language of some sort that has to be deciphered. It is the mystic's way of speaking. And in the scholarly world, some, especially in the new students of Kabbalah in the scholarly world, they like to talk like this, that, well, can't understand it quite literally, but you can't quite say it's fantasy. It's somewhere in between. And again, if you pester this position, you say, well, what do you mean? You know, were the mystics privy? Did they see something? And they're still going to have to fess up. Even by saying it's a symbol for something else, you still have to say, well, they saw something and reported it in symbolic language. And then you have to again say they saw something. If they saw nothing, then it's either fantasy or, well, or just some sort of subjective fantasy. Now, here we stumble willy-nilly onto one of the greatest questions confronting philosophers in the modern era, and especially those that want to ascend to religious faith. The general tendency of modern philosophic thought is to say that truth is inaccessible. All we have are systems. Systems are all self-contained. Language only makes sense within the confines of the system. There is no overarching objective truth, et cetera, et cetera. And again, this plays right into the hand of sort of the neo-Kabbalistic students who will say that the Kabbalistic Lashon is just one other kind of boxed-in, limited language which works within its own specific system, but there is nothing beyond that. There is no truth that transcends all systems. So this is all by way of an introduction to Hasidus, because Hasidus Sfarim are, by and large, a continuation of this Kabbalistic trend to say things about reality. And when people will tell you that they find satisfaction, meaning, inspiration in Hasidus Sfarim, they're probably saying, if I can translate their statements, something like the following. When I read in Hasidus Sfarim ABC about Shabbos and Yom Tov, which describes Shabbos and Yom Tov, or mitzvahs, as doing something in the cosmos, or doing something in my soul, then I feel more inspired when I approach Shabbos and Yom Tov and mitzvahs. When they say they find inspiration, they are saying to you that the mitzvah to love one's fellow Jew, or all mankind, which one would be hard-pressed to find in Kabbalistic Hasidic literature or in any Jewish literature, the mitzvah to love others, when I study Hasidus, I see that loving the other is a part of a linkage of souls, and that it's the yearning of one human soul for another. So what they're saying is that the peering behind the veil of reality is making me feel that Torah and mitzvahs and Shabbos and Yom Tov and Ahavas and all these things are deeper and more meaningful than simply the surface seems to reveal. So once again, the inspiration that is derived from these sources is predicated, I think, upon some kind of assumption that they do see accurately behind the veil. And once again, the neo-Hasidic scholars would say, well, it's a metaphor and it's a symbol and it's not really literal, it's really seeing. But again, if it's seeing something else and expressing it in poor symbolic language, it's still seeing something. If it's seeing nothing, once again, we're locked into the box of language and imprisoned systems. And again, as I said before, the moral problems, and here I talk about contemporary values as the second definition of our modern Jew, morality for us moderns usually is some kind of universal affair. We like to think that moral values are applied to all men. And again, in Hasidic literature, as in Kabbalistic literature, the distinction between the Jew and the non-Jew is very heavily brought across. So this moral dilemma is further shoved and thrust into our kishkas by the Hasidic and Kabbalistic literature. Now, this is thus far the critical and reflective part of our talk, except that the third definition of the modern Jew that I gave you, which is popular culture and a openness and receptivity to our social environment, is very receptive to a subjective, personal rendering of human experience, by which I mean the following. The modern person pursues entertainment, vacation, art, literature, culture, whatever he does, generally by saying and feeling that these things are relevant to him or her. They are personally relevant. They resonate with me. I am the center. And therefore, I think that if one goes into contemporary bookstores, one sees a lot of Kabbalistic literature. In fact, one can at times find more Kabbalistic literature than one can find basic literature on Judaism. One finds more talk about Sufi literature than about basic Islam. One finds more theosophy than one finds standard Christianity. So that the modern man seems to gravitate towards this, towards the esoteric. And that could well be because it fits in well with a subjective understanding and deciphering of reality, that we recoil from objective truth, we recoil from an objective rendering of what is, and therefore these Kabbalistic schools seem to the modern to be some kind of subjective way of reading reality, but of course the truth is that they are just the reverse, that they are making the most audacious claims in terms of the objective nature of reality. Now, can we rescue this literature for the modern Jew and make it something that is relevant to him? And here we're going to have to address the historical problems, the question of authenticity. We're going to have to address the question of to what degree is this literature objectively true, and then we're going to have to address the question of whether it can or cannot be inspirational. Now, in order to answer that question, I think we have to backtrack a bit and explore the nature of truth as it relates to Judaism altogether. The medievals believed that one could prove objective metaphysical truths. And therefore, Jews and Christians and Muslim philosophers and the ancient Greeks were engaged in a great rational debate to prove which religion, which philosophy was true, capital T. That has fallen very much into a disrepute today. We are told, and I guess so many years of going at it, and so many different schools of thought, and so much literature and ink and blood spilt in the pursuit of truth, has rendered modern men, or at least modern men in the West, let's just say as a little parenthesis to this whole talk, as everything I've said about moderns here applies only to Europe and North America, and the rest of the world is in a very, very different state as regards truth and God and piety and so forth. Whether better or worse is a subject for a different discussion. But certainly I've been talking about us, which is Europe and North America. Today we no longer feel the truth can be proven. Now, we'll leave that aside for a second, but let's just assume that it is true the truth cannot be proven, which again is a contradiction in terms. But what are we left with if that is the case? Are we left with a subjectivist prison in which we can get nowhere, or is there some other means to access objective truth? In other words, can some combination of logic and proof and argument combined with some other means yield at the end of the day truth? Dr. David Schatz, a professor at YU, once told me that Rav Soloveitchik, when asked whether or not Judaism can be proven, he said, well, logically, it's about 50-50. And I found that a very interesting comment. And I think what we have to do to understand that comment is to ask, so where did he get the second 50% from? In other words, how did he access truth beyond what logic, argument, and scholarship led him? And I think the answer to that question, and I'm going to just throw out something which for moderns is uncomfortable, but I'm going to use the phrase that Hasidic Sfarim used, and I'm so sure maybe of Soloveitchik might not have been comfortable with it, but I think at the end of the day, that's what he's saying here. And that is, we have emunah, that there is a gift of faith that we can access by various means, by looking at a starry sky, by looking at our grandchildren's smiles, by sitting down to a Seder, by hearing a niggun, by davening, by figuring out a difficult tosfos. There are a lot of sources of faith in the world. And when we access those sources of emunah pshuta, those graces of emunah pshuta, and combine them with whatever degree that we feel scholarship, logic, and argument can push us, then I think that is how the modern Jew believes in the sense of believing in truth, in capital T. Anything else, I think, is not really an authentic, and again, far be it for me to say this, but to see the whole thing as a subjectivist prison, as a metaphor, as a symbol, I think is to strip faith of what faith has always been. And it's to yield us simply art and not faith. But I think the statement of Soloveitchik is very instructive in this regard. C.S. Lewis uses the mushal of a person is going down a road and keeps seeing signs, 60 miles to London, 50 miles to London. And the last 5 miles or so, there are no more signs. And you continue on your own and you arrive in London. And he said, well, faith is somewhat similar, that there are signs along the road on the way to the world of faith. But at a certain point, the signs just aren't there anymore. And we have to just keep the car revved up, heading in that direction. But if we do that, we eventually arrive in London. Now, what I've done is taken what should be for all of us a lifetime of thought and prayer and religious experience, and try to distill it in a 2-3 minute description of what emunah pshuta, what emunah can be for a modern Jew. So I hope you will forgive me for having been so almost flippant and brief in my description of the process. But I had to be, in order to bring us back to the subject at hand, which is how we are to approach Kabbalah and Hasidus in this whole literature. Now, I am assuming that this literature, if we see it as in some way true, can in fact provide us with great inspiration. And particularly the Hasidic literature, which I think gives you the theurgic world of Kabbalah once removed and presents us with a inspired understanding of, as I said before, Torah, Mitzvah, Shabbos, Yontif, love, Midos, and so on and so forth. But what are we to make of the critical questions? What are we to make of the historical questions? What are we to make of the moral questions? What are we to make of the questions of how much of this is truth and how much of this is symbol? Well, I think, and here I can only offer you what I do, and hope that it might strike a chord, perhaps, with the audience. I sort of let the cat out of the bag at the very beginning of this lecture when I said that every segment of the world-believing world Jewry, Hasidim, Misnagdim, Svardim, all have accepted this literature as true. Now, true may admit of certain symbolic interpretation. That is indeed possible. But I think in order to have this be true, and not just meaningless subjectivist imprisonment, then I think we're going to have to say that there is some divine access. There is some divine opening up of the veil of reality, which Mekubalim, saints, mystics, throughout the centuries have been able to peer behind that veil and bring back to us certain things. Now, understand, though, the gaps. The gaps are created by the fact that we are physical, imperfect beings. The gaps are created by the fact that peering behind the veil of reality is obviously going to be, I mean, I've never peered there, but I would assume it's not all that clear, that one does not understand the essence of the divinity or of the cosmos with absolute clarity. So that the testimony is vague to an extent, our understanding and appreciation of it is vague to an extent, and the entire realm has to be approached with what I would say is a hearty dose of humility. But that hearty dose of humility leads us to say much more often, I don't know and don't understand, than it would lead us to say we are dealing with fantasy. How does one reach that decision? I think it is simply an existential question that we are confronted with. Much as we are confronted with various critical problems about the main body of faith. For those people who are in the academic world, there are lots of problems that lie in wait for us on all sides. And there are very often moments when the believing Jew, when confronted by these scholarly and moral problems, must say, as did the Baal Shem on his deathbed, Ich bin ein Narr und ich glaube. I am a fool and I believe. That we must approach this literature with humility, we must approach it with a sense of its sanctity. And doing so, I don't think we have to answer absolutely all the questions that I raised before. I do not have absolute answers for all these questions. I can direct you to scholars who try to explain and answer some of the problems I mentioned before in terms of the Zohar. I can direct you to those who will try to understand Hasidus and Kabbalah by the light of a moralism that is more universal and more attuned to many of our own souls. I can do all that for you. But my primary point is that when one is dealing with such worlds of extraordinary sanctity, way beyond the grasp of human intuition, that humility is our primary calling. There are going to be moments, I think, as we explore Hasidus and Kabbalah, there are going to be moments when we explore Tanakh, Chumash, Gemara, where we are going to be struck by things that puzzle us. There are going to be struck with things that confuse us, things that hurt us sometimes to our core. But I think that should just encourage us. And I remember last time I was here and I gave a talk about the moral questions. Someone raised their hand afterwards and said, well, you know, if you have all these problems, you know, why persevere? You know, why not throw out the whole thing? And of course, throwing out the baby with the bathwater will accomplish nothing for us. If we have felt within Torah and mitzvahs, if we have felt within Hasidus and Kabbalah, that which has uplifted us and brought us closer to the divine, that which has made us better people in relation to our neighbors, that which has brought us in tune with the spiritual, then we must persevere in the face of critical and moral questions. Now, obviously, critical and moral questions can reach a certain mass, which will be debilitating. And at that point, there is only prayer. But up until that point, I think we persevere. As modern men and women, there is no other choice. There is no other choice. We are cast adrift in a world in which doubt stalks us on all sides. We can no longer refer to the five proofs of Aquinas. We can no longer even open up the Kuzari and believe at the end of the day that we have answered all questions and solved all problems. But my answer at that point, which I'd like to give to you and say, explore it, run with it as best you can. My answer at that point is to say, Ich bin ein Narr und ich glaube, fortify oneself with Torah and mitzvahs, fortify oneself with Kedusha and Tahara, fortify oneself with humility and love, and then slowly but surely, clouds are lifted, problems are done away with, and we are able, even in our reflective and academic selves, we are able to overcome problems. Do not throw out the baby with the bathwater, but avail oneself of the good that can be uplifting while prayerfully seeking a solution to some of the dilemmas that exist. This is the only way, I think, that modern man can preserve faith in general, and the only way that he can preserve faith in an esoteric realm,
which I think is a great guarantor of the ultimate meaning, of the ultimate meaning and depth of our spiritual strivings. Thank you. If there are any questions, we have... Yes?
If anybody has a question, if you could go to the microphone and ask it, please, it would be appreciated.
With respect, Rabbi Schiller, I would ask you, you mentioned... Rav Joseph Soloveitchik of blessed memory, in his great book, that he wrote about the lack of faith.
The Lonely Man of Faith.
Pardon?
The Lonely Man of Faith?
Yes, The Lonely Man of Faith. Where does he rest in this dichotomy which you have expressed?
To the best that I can understand, Rav Soloveitchik, although he does not make extensive use of Kabbalistic literature or Hasidic literature, was very much a traditionalist when it came to these questions, and does at times refer to Zohar, refer to Chabad Hasidus, and I think, again, this is just a guess, that he was deeply loyal to the Lithuanian traditions of his ancestors. And I don't think that he could possibly have, with the Gra and Rav Chaim Volozhinin, I don't think he could have in any way stepped out, and perhaps I'm wrong and others disagree, but I don't think he could have stepped out of a belief in the ultimate authenticity of this literature, although I don't think it played a large role in his conscious teachings. Oh, I see. I see you're referring to the ultimate questions of faith, not so much the Kabbalistic questions. I mean, in terms of faith in general. Oh, yeah, well, I think the fact that he said, you know, logically it's 50-50, here's my chiddush for the day, that I think that what he's saying when he says that is very similar to what the B'nai Salska and the Duvodal Tolner and Nachman Vreslava and the whole Emunah Pshuta school is saying. They're saying we cannot arrive at faith by logical means, but there is another means, and I think that's his second 50%. That combination of psychology, person, human experience, mitzvahs, that is the second 50%. And there is a vote from the Kutzke, which I think is very instructive in this regard. The Kutzke once said that they told him that a certain Rebbe had Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration. And the Kutzke said, I have Emunah. With Emunah, one can see much clearer than with Ruach HaKodesh. Yes. Any more questions? Yes. I'm sorry. Please.
Any more questions?
Yeah. It's supposed to follow me. Sure.
While I realize this was not the topic of your talk, I nevertheless still would like to hear your personal opinion on this question. Whether there is any redeeming value to the Kabbalah Center and its relationship to the non-Jewish world, just like we know that Christianity had its value in terms of bringing monotheism to the world, whether there's any value to the Kabbalah Center in that respect.
The real honest answer to the question, and this is going to sound like I'm trying to sneak out of it, is that I don't know all that much about it to be able to comment. I would think that Kabbalah without basic assent to Torah mitzvahs is somewhat out of kilter, somewhat out of whack. But could a person conceivably, through them or through that, come to an assent to Torah mitzvahs? Maybe. But my essential answer is that I'm just not that up on exactly what it is they believe and teach. So I can't answer that. And that's it. Well, there are no more questions. Oh, no, I have to say no. I'm saying I'm being told that I can't answer it.
Oh, you're
done. One more. I've got a dispensation for one more question.
One more minute.
Oh, my goodness. Quick, yes.
I'll try to ask quickly. Rabbi Arya Kaplan in his books speaks very much about people in the time of Beit HaMikdash being very comfortable with this other 50%, and schools of meditation and mystical experience being very normative for those people. He speaks also about the advent of modernity being something that cut us off from that other 50%. Are there any people in our world today that you know of that actually do peer behind this veil and can bring us current information that they have seen it so that we can trust that it does exist?
There are those that think there are such people. I would say I don't know.
Okay. Yasher Koch, Rav Schiller, thank you very much for that enlightening talk. Rabbi Mordechai Becher will be speaking here now. Rabbi Michael Broyd will be downstairs. And Susan Schneider is in chat. In room 202, their lecture start immediately.